Welcome to this episode of the Physicians Weekly Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Rachel Giles from Medicom Medical Publishers, in collaboration with Physicians Weekly. Every September 22nd, or 922, in acknowledgement of the Philadelphia chromosome translocation 922, is World CML Day, Chronic Myeloid Leukemia. And today's podcast will take different lenses on the Lancet Hematology's Committee on Adverse Events and how side effects are reported and analyzed. We speak with two of the members of this committee, the CEO of the CML Advocates Network, Jan Geisler, and also the chair of this committee, hematologist at the Mayo Clinic, Dr. Geeta Thanarajasingham. This is not a story about CML per se, but a much broader topic about how this committee intends to change how adverse events are assessed and reported, as Dr. Thanarajasingham points out.
Patient-reported outcomes and tolerability data are important and complementary to our historical data on adverse events, and that we need to watch our language when we get out there and we say, oh, this therapy was generally well tolerated.
But first, we speak with Jan Geisler, currently working from Valencia, Spain, about his experience as a CML patient has led him to become an expert advocate. Enjoy listening. I'm going to start off by just asking you, Jan, to introduce yourself. Would you mind just telling the world who you are?
Sure. My name is Jan Geisler. I'm the co-founder of the CML Advocates Network, a network of leukemia patient groups in more than 90 countries. And I'm also a cancer survivor, a CML patient, a patient advocate that has been involved in many different initiatives around patient advocacy and patient engagement.
Now, adorably, you've chosen 922 as your Awareness Day. Could you talk about World CML Awareness?
Yeah, sure. I mean, we chose 922 or 22nd of September because the chromosomes 9 and 22 are the cause for chronic leukemia, the CML, which I actually have. And it's the perfect day to actually think about what kind of progress have we made, what is important for the patient community, and how can we work together to make the future better for patients with CML. So that's what we do in 922 usually.
And what is this year's? Do you have a certain theme this year that's special to? Do you change that every year? Or is it just general awareness?
No, I think we have different topics every year, even though, you know, we're a network that is in all continents, in all kinds of regions. We cover more than 90 countries. And of course, the needs of the community are very diverse from, let's say, the very sophisticated problems we have in Western countries down to basic access in many low and middle income countries. So, of course, the spread is very wide. And the motto of this year of World CML Day is United in Community and Purpose towards a cure for CML. Because, I mean, CML is quite unique. We have 20 years of tremendous and exciting revolution in terms of how CML was treated. When I was diagnosed in 2001, actually, the odds were not great. So bone marrow transplant was the standard treatment. Mortality was high. The medical treatments were not really good. And then came a new treatment that totally turned our world upside down. And today, if patients have access to all available treatments, they can live a long life. But they need to take the treatment. Most of them need to take the treatment lifelong. And of course, there are side effects, which in the long run can be very bothering. And if you can't access current therapies, it's as deadly as it was before. And that's why you can see that, let's say, the difference. And what we actually as a community experienced is that we need to be united. We need to work together. We need to work together with researchers. We need to work together as a community to share best practice, to share resources, to be more of a common voice. And you might think that the problems are so different, but we have often experienced how important it is to actually align and work together, and that the Western, the Eastern, the Northern, the Southern communities, the rich and the more poor, work together for a common cause. And that's why we called it this year United in Community and Purpose towards a cure in CML, because that's what we want, work together and achieve a cure.
Absolutely. And during the years that you've been in this community, and no one volunteers for this sort of, like, I want to grow up and be a CML patient. That's never an idea. You're thrust into it, but you find that you've adapted quite a bit. I mean, you actually were diagnosed and were working with this community before imatinib. Is that correct?
Yeah, well, that was my first drug, but at that time, it was not approved yet. So I joined a phase two clinical trial. I mean, by coincidence, I read about the phase three study that was going on, was reported at ASH. And then I had five different medical opinions from different doctors, all kinds of things. And the fifth one I spoke to then actually said, well, we've got this new drug, which is currently being assessed. It's not available yet. But I have a single center phase two study in my center, which you could join. Take your time, think about it. And if you want, join us. So I joined that study with 19 other CML patients and got access to two unapproved drugs, of which one I used an off-label for many years. The other one got approved as imatinib then later on.
I see. And then now we're on to third generation drugs for CML patients, right? Is that correct? I mean, we've learned a lot about resistance to the drugs that are available for CML. And now there's been some adaptations based on those resistance pockets, I guess. What is the current state of the art from your perspective? And what are the obstacles that CML patients still experience?
Well, I mean, we got in total six drugs on the market now, because the sixth drug, the third generation or fourth generation, however you count, has just been approved by FDA and also EMA for third line use. And so from that perspective, of course, most of the second and third generation drugs have been developed based on an understanding how resistance mechanisms work and how the pocket changes where this small molecule fits, and actually modifying the molecule in a way that it fits into the pocket in another way. So that was the first five drugs, and the sixth drug that has just come to market binds on the same more or less protein, but from a different angle. So it's a different way of mechanism. In the new drug, asciminib, how they call it, and it binds at a different pocket of BCR-ABL. This is exciting, and let's say early data from the trial seems to be quite well tolerated, and it seems to work on a lot of patients that developed resistance against the other drugs. So from that perspective, there's great hope. But I mean, they all have one thing in common: they all don't cure. So we have experienced after years and years of treatment, about 25% of patients can stop treatment and stay in remission. But many patients never develop the level of response that you need for that. And about 50% of people, even after years of remission, relapse. So they need to restart treatment, which actually means that only a small proportion of patients can actually do what we call TFR, therapy-free remission, which of course, a patient like me, I've stopped in 2014 after 13 years of treatment, which of course was a big grace for me. But I'm lucky. Most are not. And all drugs don't cure. And that's why the second motto actually of all this year's World CML Day is that we need to develop a cure. And for us, cure is not necessarily what these 25% get, that after years of treatment you can stop. It's actually cure for everyone, and it is actually a cure that is, let's say, likely to eradicate disease so it doesn't come back. And that doesn't seem like the case for most of the patients under current six therapies. So there's still a lot to do. And for those people that actually say CML is a tick box, it's not, we're far away. The good thing about CML is that we understand it a lot. So we can research on that, and we can, similar to what we were 20 years ago, being a bit of a pilot disease where we actually understand how a disease like that develops, how you tackle resistance, and how you probably move towards a cure. Because when I was diagnosed in 2001, everybody said, except a couple of crazy doctors, they actually said, this is never going to work. These small molecules, you will develop resistance. Everybody will be back to do bone marrow transplant after a short while. And that didn't happen. So that's the cool thing about research.
That's terrific. I mean, in some respects, when I was studying medicine, CML was the only targeted therapy that was around. It's really a pioneer in that respect. So what's your next step, and what are the obstacles that patients and patient groups experience when working with companies and also with their doctors and trying to get trials and access to care?
Well, on one thing, and I mentioned that before, is that people think CML is a tick box. So they think, well, there are six therapies on the market. Well, let's move elsewhere where problems are larger. But I think on one hand, we need to think about sustainability for our healthcare system. I mean, our prevalence, luckily, is rising because more and more people have CML, live with CML, but need to take their drugs on an ongoing basis. And even if you talk about generics, because the first of our drugs like imatinib medication have been available as generics for a while, it's still unaffordable for many and it's still inaccessible for many. And from that perspective, I think we're far away from a tick box. And the second thing is, and that's a huge thing for all cancers in the end, if we're as successful as we hope for, that nobody's dying of cancer anymore, then it's quite likely a lot of people will need to live lifelong with therapies. So quality of life and survivorship are a huge issue. And that's sometimes what we forget in CML. I mean, I took the drug for years and I had all kinds of nausea and rash and whatever kind of thing and muscle cramps. And even they might be low grade. So a clinician might say, well, tolerable drug and it's all fine. I must say this is annoying over time. It really impacts your quality of life, your family life. You think about family planning. You have fatigue and nausea, which impacts your workability. And so the impact on daily living is high. And two of the six drugs, for example, require fasting. So 2 hours before a meal, 1 hour after the meal, you need to fast because one drug has lower blood levels. The other one, it increases the blood levels if you eat. So you have all kinds of complications. And I mean, try that with gummy bears for 1 month, that you take a gummy bear in the morning and a gummy bear in the evening, and you need to fast 2 hours before and 1 hour after. You can actually see how large the impact on your quality of life is if you can't go to dinner with friends anymore because you need to obey your fasting periods. And this just demonstrates that medically, clinically, we might have solved it in the countries where you can access everything, but still there are huge impacts on patients like me that need to take the drugs probably lifelong. And that's a huge issue we need to tackle.
That's great. And if I could just distill like one or two messages that you want to share with our colleague physicians out there, what would they be with regard to how to best care for CML patients?
Well, one thing is, let's say, look at the human being as a whole, because it's not just the CML that you treat, it's the impact on their life and their priorities. So see what they need. It might be that they might try, let's say, best optimal therapy, even though toxicity might be higher, to get into therapy-free remission, to stop treatment very soon. Or they might be okay to take drugs, but they would be relying more on something that has been on the market for 20 years. So priorities are different. Do they want to do family planning? So you need to get them into remission that they can actually have children. Or what is their context in terms of quality of life? What's their expectation? I think that dialogue needs to happen early on, because you've got the choice between different therapies today. But it doesn't mean highest clinical efficacy is the choice that that patient might take. Or another thing, talk about adherence. They might have a life that is not very linear, so adherence might be an issue. So how do you address that, that people can take their drugs as prescribed, that they have a chance to live a long life? So all these kind of things need to happen. And I think the time in the beginning, the discussion about individual patient priorities and the expectation not only on how to deal with CML, but also with quality of life is extremely, and their life planning is extremely important on the onset. And then you take it from there and see how body's responding to therapy and how you move it from there.
That's clear. So lots of work to do still. Thank you. So thank you for your time. I appreciate it. I know I just saw you yesterday in Paris, but it's good to see you again. Thank you for your time.
Yeah, great pleasure. Really nice to see you again, Rachel.
Next, we speak with Dr. Geeta Thanarajasingham of the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. She talks about the Lancet Hematology Committee on the Assessment and Reporting of Adverse Events, and it turns out she's a rather big fan of Jan Geisler's. We refer to an article published in JAMA in 2017 by Professor Ethan Bash, and this citation is provided on the Physicians Weekly website.
Yeah, you know, Jan Geisler and I got connected because I am leading an initiative for the Lancet Hematology called the Commission on Adverse Events. And the reason I became interested in this work many years ago was I realized that we did actually quite a poor job in cancer medicine, sort of across the board, of understanding how our patients feel and function on treatment. So, you know, we put a lot of emphasis, rightly so, into improving cure rates and novel therapeutics. And for the longest time, almost all of our cancer treatments were cytotoxic agents. So usually intravenous treatments that we administer that kill rapidly dividing cells somewhat nonspecifically. The tyrosine kinase inhibitors, the drugs that first came around and had, you know, miraculous response rates, and those were one of the first non-cytotoxic chemos to have a profound impact, curing a disease that was not felt to be curable in some cases, or in most likely cases, having people live with their disease as a chronic condition rather than dying from it. And, you know, we've always looked at side effects of treatment as if it's not severe, requiring hospitalization or life-threatening, then we'll tolerate it because, you know, we want the efficacy. But when you think about oral treatments that are chronically administered, or some of the newer treatments we have that are immune therapies, cellular therapies like CAR T, you have to think about toxicity differently than when we used to say, okay, we're going to give 6 cycles of chemical medications, you know, once every 3 weeks for a total of 6 times, and then we're done. This calculus now of, you know, how our patients feel and function over time on treatment matters a lot more than it used to when we were focused on, okay, we just want cancer patients to live. You know, we have improved outcomes, the, you know, progression-free and overall survival rates in a lot of different cancers. And we haven't really modernized our approach to looking at side effects or the patient experience of treatment as the types of treatment have changed and led to these improved outcomes. So I'll give you an example. When we talk about toxicity or side effects of cancer treatment, there's a grading system that we use called the CTCAE. And usually a grade 3 or 4 event is something that's life-threatening that puts someone in the hospital. Grade 5 is a side effect that causes that patient's death. So historically, in all of our publications, we've got tables that show the incidence of grade 3 or 4 severe effects. But if you're, you know, Jan Geisler, and you're receiving therapy for CML, and you've been taking imatinib for years at a time, but you have an effect that limits your ability to live your life or impacts your quality of life. I hate to use this example, but it illustrates it very well. Grade 2 diarrhea in this grading classification we have is bowel movement 4 to 6 above baseline. So if someone has 2 stools a day, they could have up to 8 stools a day, and that would be considered a grade 2 event. And yet that's usually not reported in these tables, and people are, you know, clinicians are sort of trained to be like, ah, low grade stuff, they're tolerating it well. But I challenge you to think of anybody who can function in their life, in their work, as a parent, or in any other role they have, having, you know, this type of intrusive side effect. And that's a great example of why we have to look at side effects differently. That's what the Adverse Event Commission started out of, to say, you know, how do we change the culture here? The therapies have changed, the outcomes have changed, but what about how patients feel and function on these treatments? Can we bring the patient voice in? Can we use patient-reported outcomes? Can we use novel methods of how we look at adverse event data, not just the high-grade events that put people in the hospital, but the ones that are interfering how they function? Because we've always had this concept of safety and tolerability of cancer treatment. And safety is, you know, is it okay with the person's organ function? And, you know, it's safe, it's not putting them in the hospital, the drug is not killing them. Yes, very important. I'm not saying we should supersede that. But we sometimes use tolerability as an interchangeable concept when really something can be safe for you, but it's completely intolerable. And really, to understand this concept of tolerability, you have to involve the patient's perspective, because what may be tolerable to you on an oral therapy for a cancer may be completely intolerable to me. And so that's what some of this work started out of. And then we sort of decided to break up this initiative looking at, you know, can we analyze the side effect data from clinical trials that we have in different and better ways? Yes. Can we incorporate patient-reported outcomes? Yes. How about how any of this work applies to newer therapies such as CAR T and transplant in hematologic malignancies? What about long-term toxicity in people who've survived, who have curable intent malignancies, but we've really done an incomplete job of cataloging their experience down the line and what they need to be monitored for, both physically, psychosocially, and emotionally? And then, because when you do adverse event work, there's a very key stakeholder that needs to be at the table, and that's regulators. So like FDA, EMA, all of these people from around the globe, because they're the ones that sort of are the gatekeepers to safety and adverse event data. And so when they require something, people that conduct studies will learn to provide it. And so we had them at the table talking about, you know, how do we make adverse event reporting actually helpful and informative and reflect the patient experience? And then the last section where Jan was very critical to was the real world section, because the first five sections sort of focused on clinical trials and understanding novel therapeutics in more patient-centered ways. How do we take what we're learning on clinical trials and apply them to the real-world patients? How do we leverage real-world patient data to understand side effects and the patient experience? And so he's provided a lot of expertise in that regard with his network. So very grateful for that.
We're both big Jan fans. That's good.
it's advocates that I think really changed the game. In the last few years, I think there's been a lot more understanding about the value and the high level of involvement that we can have from patient advocates, you know, for example, in designing research protocols. You know, we used to not ask patients for their input. We would say, okay, well, this is the drug, this is what we want to test, this is what we think we should do. And, you know, I have learned so much about patient advocate co-investigators and how they can really inform a study design, how they can make it more successful, how they can inform patient-reported outcomes. And I think the tides are really turning in sort of innovative ways of conducting new research because of advocates.
If you look at some of the very advanced, the HIV/AIDS community that really started off the advocacy to a highly professional level, the pink ribbon movement as well, you know, people making noises and making changes as a result. Now the level of advocacy is really, truly, they generate data, right?
I would agree with that. I struggled a lot when I was graduating my fellowship, and I'd always focused in this type of work. And most people around me are, you know, translational researchers. They are wanting to have one foot in a basic science lab to develop new compounds and bring those compounds to patients, and super important work. And I sort of had this complex of, well, you know, I do soft science. But like you say, I now have a very large statistical team that I work with who understand data in rigorous ways that I never could pretend to as a simple clinician. I take what they, you know, are able to do with AE data, and I then bring it to the clinic to try to benefit my patients. So I call myself, instead of calling myself a social scientist or even a health outcomes researcher, I now call myself a translational health outcomes researcher. In fact, I lead a group called the Lymphoma Thors of people who are, you know, bringing this type of science, legitimizing it, and, you know, bringing it into the clinic. Because most of my colleagues who conduct clinical trials, you know, they don't know a rigorous way to put patient-reported outcomes in. They don't know how you would analyze that data. When there is missing patient-reported outcome data, it means something very different than when the clinician forgot to fill out the AE form. It could mean your patient's hospitalized or they're suffering from side effects that are so severe that they, and so you need to understand how to analyze that and to do so in a rigorous and consensus manner. So that's kind of the field that I've been involved in. That's my part of the overall field. But the effort that Jan has helped me lead with the Lancet Hematology is kind of even more far-reaching of, okay, just beyond analysis and collecting this data, you know, how do we actually move this field forward to actually improve the treatment experience for patients?
That's really important work. And I one final question is, I know that you've published significantly with Ethan Bash. And Ethan, I mean, really had an eye-opening JAMA paper in 2017, and I think gave the ASCO address as well, presidential address or at the plenary.
Plenary, yep.
Phenomenal work. And I just wanted to think, are PROs, are we underusing them? Is this the next blockbuster drug?
Yes. I mean, Ethan has said it much more eloquently, but if the survival advantage that he had shown at his ASCO plenary and in that article that you referenced was due to a drug, there would have been all sorts of, you know, fanfare and media, and, you know, this would have become a very expensive drug. Instead, it was asking patients how they feel and function. That alone led to a survival improvement because, you know, we were able to factor that information in and there was a response to that information. And so I think it was a very powerful demonstration of patient-reported outcomes and incorporating them scientifically into one's practice. I think a lot of the historical skepticism about this has been, well, I know how to take a history, you know, so I can get the information from my patient. But getting it directly from the patient has the potential to improve lots of outcomes, survival included, in metastatic cancer patients. So that was a really powerful moment. And yes, Ethan has been one of my main mentors. I've been very lucky. I sort of came in the door of looking at, you know, clinically recorded adverse event data. And then as I sort of forayed into, well, what does this really mean to a patient? And we need complementary information from clinicians saying, okay, this is what my patient told me, or this is what the labs tell me. We need to hear from the patient directly, because you don't understand how something interferes with someone's function or quality of life without asking them directly. And by asking them and potentially intervening on it, you can actually improve their survival.
Amazing work. Is there anything else you'd like to share with your physician colleagues?
I just want to say that, you know, I think patient-reported outcomes and tolerability data are important and complementary to our historical data on adverse events, and that we need to watch our language when we get out there and we say, oh, this therapy was generally well-tolerated. If you didn't ask patients and you didn't do so in a high-quality health outcomes study with rigorous outcomes, then you may not know that to be true. And so we really do need to listen to our patients the way we do in clinic, but in research as well.
Excellent. So thank you so much for your time.
Thanks so much, Rachel.
That's all the time we have for today's podcast. Thank you so much for listening. Stay safe and stay healthy.
Physicians Weekly is produced in collaboration with Medicom Medical Publishers and Physicians Weekly.